Iku Iluna. Please rise. Ahea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuleana imua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki iki hanahano okamoku aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e maliu mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-23-0000296. State of Hawaii, respondent plaintiff appellee versus Marlon L. Lavoie, petitioner, defendant appellant. Arguing for the petitioner, Marlon Lavoie, Matthew Combe. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Chad Kumagai. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed? All right. We've allocated 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Combe, you wanted a warning with 5 minutes to go in your initial argument, so we'll give you that warning. Mr. Kumagai, we will give you a five-minute warning as well. Please proceed, Mr. Combe.
Good morning. May it please the court, Matthew Combe on behalf of the petitioner. I'm here today and I appreciate the court's taking this case on petition. This case has been around on and off in some ways for the last 10 years and it's been before this court before. The issues today are a little bit narrower, but just as important nonetheless because they involve due process and constitutional issues at sentencing, because the disconnect here from the petitioner's standpoint is that they agreed to a plea of extreme mental and emotional disturbance, which triggers some mitigating factors, some culpability that's less, and yet those things weren't considered at sentencing. It started with the request for funds for an expert to do a dangerousness assessment. I would submit to this court that there also seems to be a conflated idea of that a capacity 704 exams are the same thing as a dangerousness assessment. Now, this court, you know, looking at it, usually it's the prosecutor that does a dangerousness assessment, and it's done because things for like extended sentencing. But it is relevant also when there's issues that regards things like EMED. And in this case, that the court, based totally on money and the cost of things, that it denied it. And under Supreme Court case law, it's clear that a defendant is entitled to funds, especially an indigent defendant is entitled even at sentencing. And it becomes even more important in a case like this because these were the issues. I mean, the parties and the government offered this plea, that means there were some issues here. And I can go into this for the court that
Counsel, can I ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you know, on this dangerousness issue, it seemed like the court kind of brush past it, kind of prejudged the usefulness of obtaining additional dangerousness assessment. Can you explain what it is that you were trying to obtain from Dr. Acklin in terms of the dangerousness aspect of the of your argument?
And thank you for focusing on that, because it's a forensic forward looking kind of assessment.
And it had been 8 years since he had been assessed, and that was a penal responsibility assessment. That the correct reading of the record?
That is correct. And it was only looking at what happened at the time to determine, was he fit to proceed or could he participate his own defense? But a
I'm sorry, was there penal responsibility assessed back then as well, or not? Just his ability to assist his counsel?
Well, there were a number of doctors that said that he knew the difference between right and wrong, but he was substantially impaired at the time for the ability. So he had a diminished capacity defense, which he raised at trial. But this court overturned that conviction based on evidence issues and some other issues, a merger issue, and things that it was troubled with how that went. So there's a question of if the jury, we can't look backwards, but if the jury hadn't had that those improper things, would they have taken that diminished capacity argument? Maybe would it have come out in a different way? But going back to a dangerous assessment is going to look at both historical behavior and medical things, and it's also going to look at what was going on in this person's life as opposed to what's going on now 8 to 10 years later. And it gives an assessment rather than a static evaluation on a fitness to proceed. It is relevant and should be done in a case like this because the whole this case resolved on by the agreement that he had an extreme mental and emotional disturbance, which may not be clear here, but is in, and I've cited to it in my opening brief and my reply brief, is there's this whole long history. There was even in my reply brief, I think I talk about how there were two doctors in 1998 that diagnosed Lavoie with cannabis abuse, alcohol abuse, and they said rule out bipolar 1. Each two different doctors said that. That's in 1998. And then in one of the treating doctors in 2009, one of the doctors hired to do an assessment, he said that he had a history of hyperglycemia, which can bring on some kind of some issues. And then this issue happens, which, pardon me to the court, but it's triggered somewhat by this tumultuous, mean relationship between two people. And while she would bring up when she was mad at him that she would bring out his sexual abuse as a child, and she would say things like, you need to get yourself a man. She'd say, hey, bro, you need to go do that. You know, get away from me. You're ugly. I don't want you. So one of the things with a history like this, and you're humiliated, that it can bring on a psychotic incident. And what's clear in these the three, Dr. Cohn, Dr. Atkins, and Dr. Blinder all testify that there were some psychotic, it appeared that he had these kind of things. And because of that, 8 years later, 10 years later, it's relevant to do an assessment to see where he is now, which could help for his defense.
There was $1,000 was authorized at some point.
Yes.
And what was that for, and why would that have been inadequate in your view?
The defense counsel in this case, Megan Cow, she submitted a motion kind of detailed that Dr. Atkins wanted to do a dangerous assessment, and she asked for funds of $8,500, $8,500. And the court was it appeared from what was said in the record that the court was not impressed. The court said, I've read all the records here. We don't need anything else. I apologize. It may be at sentencing. He also said, you know, you can't tell me anything that I don't know. I don't need somebody to tell me about this. The biggest determiner is prior acts as to what's going to happen in the future.
But what was the $1,000 for?
That was for that she could use that to pay for somebody. But what I asked this court to consider is with due process for an indigent defendant, is that realistic? I mean, if this is $8,500 is a rate that is...
Well, you would agree that, you know,
a defendant's not entitled to an expert of their choice. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, perhaps if you're rich, you might be. But, you know, absent any further evidence, I guess that Lavoie could not have obtained an assessment for $1,000, how is there an abuse of discretion?
Because under Ake, that the U.S. Supreme Court, he is entitled to get some help.
Well, that's fine. But my question is there anything on the record or evidence to suggest that he could not have gotten that help with $1,000? I see where you want Ackland, and that's fine. He's got, you know, a reputation spanning decades in courts throughout the state. But I'm wondering, or I didn't see, and maybe you can help me, that there's anything on the record to suggest that $1,000 was not going to be sufficient for any other type of expert to come in and do the dangerous assessment or whatever you wanted that person to do.
I don't, the record does not have any indication that it was further considered. In fact, the order was never also, was never filed with the court. There was, it was an oral motion. I think what I would suggest that this court has to wrestle with is that, does it indicate a situation where this would have helped somebody at sentencing in this particular situation where the parties have agreed that there is mitigating factors which would allow for a manslaughter.
Let me ask you this too, is, you know, 706-606-2C, it's the protection of the public from future crimes. I mean, that is a key sentencing factor. I suppose after 706-606-1, the nature and history, or nature and circumstance of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant, those are key and perhaps the keyest factors. But, you know, internally, when a court is sentencing somebody, the 706, you know, 2C, protection of the public, that is, you know, I think an internal deliberation. The court's not going to want to set or give a more lenient sentence to somebody that the court thinks is going to commit future crimes. But I'm just wondering, I mean, as I look at dangerousness, which is, I suppose, difficult to predict. I mean, that's a struggle. I mean, isn't your practical effect here that on any sentencing matter, with the protection of the public being a sentencing consideration on every single sentencing, a defendant would be entitled to a defense expert on a violent crime where you know, dangerousness is at issue?
I don't think that would be the case, and that's not what I'm asking this court to do. It is particularly to this case, because when it also, well, also under 706 is that the court must, the trial court has to fashion a sentence which takes into it must address also the particularities about the particular, that the defendant and getting them the help that they need, but also,
doesn't that happen on every single sentencing matter? And I guess I'm just wondering is what standard would you have us use to differentiate your client from any other client who the state is arguing, hey, this is a bad person and is dangerous and needs to be kept in?
I would ask this court, under the totality of the circumstances of what happened here, is that it's led to a lesser included manslaughter, which involves an agreement that in the plea agreement that there was extreme mental and emotional disturbance, then the trial court says it does not allow a dangerousness person, but then later says at sentencing that it wouldn't believe them anyway, and it was based on money. And case law has said an indigent defendant can't be deprived just based on price or cost if it would help them. Now, I do agree that and there are cases where a person, I think there's a Hawaii case where you can't just doctor shop and keep asking for more and more doctors. But this is 8 years later. There's not enough information in there to indicate what's going on.
I guess what I hear you're saying is it's not all size fits all, that there are certain cases that present unique special circumstances that warrant the court under 8027 to find that an expert is necessary for a defense.
Yes, Justice. And also because it doesn't fit, and maybe the court was getting this, and it doesn't fit the determinations in Barrios and Bautista, because even more so that a court should be wanting to have a proper and full sentencing indicating how it made its decisions and what it did. And that wasn't the case here.
In this case, Mr. Cole, in the plea agreement, the parties agreed to that the pre-sentence report from the first case would be adopted. I mean, how does that square with what you're arguing?
Well, so that's an issue too, and the whole issue that I haven't talked about is this one case or is it two cases? The ICA, we agreed that it be used, so it would be, one of my colleagues had said, you know, you need to have it in the case that you're, I mean, there would be an argument that it was sentencing even proper, but defense counsel agreed that it would be used, so it would be ingenuine if I had made that argument to the court, so I did not. But that also shows that the parties were trying to get something done, and what could appear is that this was a results-oriented determination by the court, which doesn't comport well with the rights of indigent defendants and mentally health, mentally.
I know you've mentioned that you have said several times the trial court was just looking at the amount, but my reading of the transcripts is that he a lot of his comments were that Dr. Acklin had met with Mr. Lavoie numerous times previously, and yes, that was significant to the trial judge in determining whether what expense was necessary for
that him. Is a good point. Yes, the things of a dangerous assessment are differently, so he would need to do a current assessment, and it would be focused on, it would look at how he was in prison and what sort of family resources he has and what people may support
him. Your point is looking forward review, yes, as opposed to historical.
Yes. I mean, isn't the in prison thing, I mean, constantly defense counsel is getting up in front of circuit courts, maybe even as we speak, saying, hey, look, there's no write-ups in prison. He's not a dangerous person. He's getting sentenced 3-4 years later. I mean, that seems like just something we don't need an expert to tell the court about. How do you respond to that?
Again, where there was extreme mental emotional disturbance, it could, and a defendant may have the right to it. I urge this court to find it in a case like this, that this is needed because there was a long period of on and off mental illness and different things with different doctors. There were head injuries. There was an extreme emotionally turbulent relationship.
But isn't that EMED more of a trial issue? You're talking more about mitigation, and I don't see mitigation being a sentencing factor. I see mitigation as unfolding into the 706-6061 nature and circumstances, defend history and characteristics of the defendant's factor. You almost are suggesting that mitigation is a mandatory factor alone.
Well, one of the things that I tried to focus on is that I believed it needed to be brought up. It wasn't mentioned at all at sentencing. I also commented that, you know, the prosecutor should have addressed this somehow, and it should have been that the court, I would tell this court that it need to address that for the issue of consecutive sentencing. If essentially the court denied the funds, then 10 days before sentencing, the government files a motion asking for consecutive sentencing, and in there they argue dangerousness. They say this guy is a danger. He's a danger to society. He is mentally ill, but we don't want to punish him for that. But the truth is the argument is he didn't get the help that he needed, so he should get consecutive sentencing. And that, at least my reading of Barrios and Bautista, is that's not, this court wanted to make sure from issues of due process and right that consecutive sentencing is not being implemented unless it's clear in the record. And to not address, what I've said is there is that the court should have addressed it and said, these are the things that are said, this is what's here, and this is why I don't believe it fits here, and I'm going to do consecutive sentencing. But he didn't even do that.
You know, on that issue, I understand, I appreciate the argument you make that the possession was used consecutively as opposed to concurrently as it was used before. But the overall sentence, the counter-argument to that is that the overall sentence doesn't seem to be harsher since it was reduced to manslaughter as opposed to murder, too. What's your take on that?
I do have to agree that that could be the way the court may interpret it. But when a defendant pleads to manslaughter, it's almost as if they're telling the court that there is some mitigating factors here, but yet when they filed the motion and they asked for consecutive sentencing, they're saying it was premeditated. It wasn't spontaneous. The EMED, which says this is a spontaneous thing because...
But didn't the plea agreement say they could file a motion for consecutive sentencing? It was explicitly reserved in the plea agreement.
Yes. And my argument here is that they didn't do it correctly and that that he should have had a right to an assessment, to a dangerousness
what
assessment.
What about, come following up on Justice Devin's issue, I think in your cert application, although, and this is my question, I didn't see this in the ICA briefing, raised the question of whether the sentence was vindictive or punitive in the sense that it was run consecutive and it wasn't consecutive before. There was a life sentence and then the 20-year term for the firearms offense was run concurrently. On remand or on resentencing, it was run consecutively. And I think you're raising a Pierce versus North Carolina argument. Is that something, is that present anywhere in your briefing up until here? And if not, why wasn't it waived?
It was in my reply brief where I talk about, I would argue to the court, it wasn't waived because, it was, I believe it was in my opening brief. I'm embarrassed to tell the court that I could supplement if the court ordered that or wanted to.
You talk about the ICA now. No, I'm talking.
I'm sorry, my briefs that with the ICA. And I shouldn't assume that the court reviewed those. It just may be the cert petition.
Well, I thought there were three issues that you raised in the ICA about the sentence. One was the lack of an articulated rationale, I think. And I mean, I have the other two written down, but they didn't include the vindictiveness issue, at least that I saw. But if I'm wrong, please correct me. Lack of explanation for consecutive sentences, lack of adequate consideration of defendant's mental health issues, and alleged sentencing disparities. Those are the three issues that I saw in the ICA as points of error. Then on the cert app, there's another one, which is the sentence that the second sentence was harsher than the first. It's a different issue, I think, but I want to give you a chance to address. Perhaps you think that is part of one of those earlier issues.
I would submit to the court that it is part of the old, and I believe it's in my reply brief. I didn't, because all of my issues were sub-issues of. There were sub-issues of there's really one main issue and four sub-issues. And then, pardon me, let me see if I can.
Yeah, I'm looking at the ICA reply, and I didn't see Pierce in there, but perhaps it's just your view is it's implicit in the arguments that you were making in the ICA.
I believe that it is, and perhaps I can cite to this when I have my rebuttal to address that. I would also ask this court that should the court this court can find plain error and to the point that it might be relevant. And if I have somehow not been genuine, I apologize to the court.
No, I don't read it that way at all. But let me ask you this, is if it's more severe, and I think you make the argument that the count that he pled to commission of a separate felony with a firearm, that ran concept to count one, which is a one-time murder, now it's manslaughter. Before, it ran concurrent. So you're basically running the severity between, you know, one not being concept and one being concurrent.
Yes.
But I'm just wondering how, you know, say the third count, the B felon in possession, if and that didn't run concept before, say that actually ran concept on this one. So the aggregate isn't 40, but it's 30. Is that 30 more severe than life without possibility of parole, just like the 40? I mean, it doesn't, I'm having a hard time understanding the counts and the concept concurrent making somebody more severe versus looking at the total aggregate.
The court seemed to be, the question is could it be looked at that it was vindictive or that it was just didn't want to even consider it when it doesn't address any of the mitigating factors at sentencing and said on the record that it really would have a hard time even considering any of them. So that's a problem right there. And then, and which I mean, reflects on a defendant's, did he get a fair hearing and was his due process rights protected? And that's a question that's before this court, and it is, the net effect is, as this court knows, that you get at least a chance at being considered for parole, even on a life sentence at 20. So the net effect was to get the same kind of sentence, and I believe it was said either in the prosecution's motion for consecutive sentencing, they said we'd like to get something that's kind of like what we had before, or it was said at the hearing in the sentencing. And that's, if it's a results oriented idea to get it the same as it was, then you do the pleading to the manslaughter for EMED, it means you didn't get fair consideration of those issues. I think my time is up and I will reserved to address your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yep. Mr. Kumagai, and I guess you might need to pull the mic down just a bit. Thank you.
Chief Justice Recknerwald, Associate Justices, may it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for Respondent Plaintiff Appellee, State of Hawaii. Your Honors, there is no question that an indigent criminal defendant is entitled to litigation expenses from the government to assist in their defense. However, that right, as with other rights, may be properly qualified. In that vein, Hawaii Revised Statutes 802-7 allows defendants litigation expenses from the public purse, but only upon a showing of necessity. Here, Mr. Lavoie was afforded his right to litigation expenses. Despite never showing a specific necessity for the funds he sought, he was granted $1,000 to retain an expert. He now contends that wasn't enough. However, Mr. Lavoie is not entitled to the expert of his choice, and even if he was, he cannot overcome the circuit court's findings that Dr. Ackland's fees were outrageous and exorbitant. Nor does he provide any real basis for his request, simply stating that it had been years since his last examination. Without adhering to HRS 802-7's requisite finding of necessity, any defendant could invoke the statute to use public funds without limitation. Surely that is not a scenario that is countenanced by the statute.
Does the Second Circuit allow people to appear in sentencing via Zoom?
I believe so. And as the court is aware, Justice Cahill, Judge Cahill suggested that in the ex parte motion. So I believe that all of the expenses, I'm, of course, some of them are to examine the defendant, but not all of the expenses that Dr. Acton had invoiced for were appropriate in this case. I think the heart of the issue with respect to the expert fees is whether or not the $1,000 was a sufficient amount to satisfy the requirements of the statute. And I submit to the court that it was. The judiciary recently testified in SB 264 that the going rate for a 704 examination is $1,000. And at that rate, there were six examiners in the First Circuit who did a total of 604 examinations last year. So I know that the defendant was asking not for a 704 examination, but for dangerousness. But I think that suggests that $1,000 was a sufficient amount to retain an expert. And there's nothing in the record, even an allegation, even on appeal, that the $1,000 was not sufficient to obtain an expert in this case. Yeah, I would also note that Dr. Acklin was also previously retained for a lesser amount, $7,500, in 2015 to not only examine the defendant, but to examine the other three panel reports. And he wrote a 37-page report and testified during a trial for that amount. So I think that the court's statement that the $8,700 amount was too high is certainly well-founded.
Mr. Kumagai,
yes.
A lot of the discussion on this issue is going to the merits of it. And at
correct.
The ICA, they found that the issue was waived, or not waived, it wasn't reasserted, I guess, in the second refiled case.
Yes.
So I take it you think we should just go to the merits?
Thank you, Justice Ginoza, for that question. I think that the court could certainly rest its holding on a waiver. However, I understand the court's reluctance to find waiver of constitutional rights. And I think this is a due process right for the defendant. So the court can find a waiver, but I think it all can also go to the merits. And
the parties looked back to the records in the first case at the trial court level as well, right?
Yes.
I mean, they treated it essentially as one case.
Yes, and I think that's a fair interpretation of the record. I think that everyone kind of was on the same page the way I read the record, that, we were looking back. The court said that it had read the reports from the previous case. So I think that's a fair way to look at what we're dealing with here today. In addition, specifically with respect to Dr. Acklin, I think that, not only is the defendant not entitled to the expert of his choice, I think looking at Dr. Acklin's previous testimony and his report indicates that, I'm not sure that an examination would be fruitful. On page 2 of his report, Dr. Acklin, his May 13, 2015 report, Dr. Acklin says that the petitioner provided an overall unreliable portrait of his current attitudes and function. Throughout his report and during his testimony, Dr. Acklin stated a number of times that the defendant was malingering. And there being no change in circumstance, no allegation that the defendant has changed or is
ready. Defendant was what? What word did you use? I'm sorry.
Malingering, Your Honor.
Malingering?
Sorry, I couldn't understand.
Malingering.
Malingering.
Yes, okay. Sorry. And so without anything in the record to indicate that the defendant has changed his disposition.
Well, isn't that the point for the request? They were trying to see if there was a change. And it's not like they pulled this name out of the hat. It was somebody that was familiar with the defendant, had examined him before, and they simply were looking for an update. I know the court said the price was outrageous, but how did the court end up at $1,000? Where did that come from? Why isn't that arbitrary?
I think that the $1,000 amount is... as I stated, is the standard rate for a 704 examination. Other examiners have done these examinations at that rate. And I think that, the problem with the petitioner's position is that if all it takes to get litigation expenses is to say that it's been a long time since the defendant was examined. I think that creates a situation where defendants who were never examined have an even greater necessity to be examined at the public expense because of the 706-606 factors, which suggests that dangerousness could be considered. So I don't think that the passage of time in of itself is sufficient to find a necessity for the expense.
Well, what does the defendant need to show necessity? I mean, especially given the overwhelming number of cases in the criminal justice system don't go to trial. So necessity for defense kind of revolves around the sentencing disposition.
I think there needs to be at least an allegation that there has been some change in circumstance that's out of step with the defendant's criminal history or personal history. And there was not even an assertion to that end in the case below. So the rule that the petitioner seeks potentially opens the door to every single defendant.
Yeah, but the court wasn't denying the request.
Correct.
The court was just saying, I'm only going to give you 1,000. That's it. But you can go ahead and use the doctor. So it wasn't a real denial. Is that the way you read it?
That is the way. Yes, yes. And I think that even then, I mean, I don't think that there was a sufficient justification for the amount. But I think the court still went ahead and provided that $1,000.
Is there a double inquiry? First, we got to decide if it's necessary for the defense. Then how much?
I think that's kind of one in the same. I mean, the amount must be necessary for the defense, as well as the fact of requiring an expert. And I think both of those go into the requisite finding of necessity.
And let me ask you this. I mean, you mentioning, you know, it sort of somewhat suggests that any defendant, just because dangerousness is always a consideration for the court, protection for the public, anybody can get a dangerous expert. And I don't think Mr. Combe or anybody in this court probably agrees with that. We're not going to have a cottage industry of dangerous next experts. But let me ask you, is there any different? What about extended term sentencing versus routine sentencing? I mean, extended term sentencing, you actually need a jury finding, unless it's waived, that extra boost in time is necessary for the protection of public. Is the analysis different with respect to extended term sentencing?
I think it is, because the extended term statute specifically asks whether the defendant poses a threat to public safety. And I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact words, but the statute specifically asks that question. And I think that makes it different.
So is a defendant who comes in and requests 8027 funds after the state has filed a motion for extended term sentencing, the inquiry shifts a little bit in your mind?
It might. And you know, I know that every defendant and every criminal history is different. But to the point that the defendant is being charged with potential extended sentencing, you know, I think that suggests that there probably is a – I mean, obviously, there would be a criminal history there. That would maybe give more credence to the idea that an expert on dangerousness, you know, combining with the statute.
Because you specifically need almost that necessary protection of dangerousness. And also, it's kind of more of an adversarial setting akin to trial, right? Because unless waived, you have the jury sitting there making that, you know, extra necessary for the protection of the public finding, right?
Correct. And I think that, you know, in that setting, you know, we would also want the expert to testify on dangerousness. I mean, if there is one available. Whereas here, I think that the court mentioned that, you know, a report might be the best way to supplement the record.
Now, if the state in any sentencing matter, whether it's routine or extended term sentencing, themselves submitted an expert report, does that also change the calculus?
I think it does, because I think that the defendant should be allowed to rebut that. You know, and
that makes it necessary for the defense.
Yes, yes. That's notwithstanding the amount that the expert would require, but I think as a general matter, yes, I think that the defendant should be entitled to expert on dangerousness if the state were to bring in its own.
So at the hearing in which the court denied the 8,700 but authorized 1,000, at the same time, if I understand correctly, the trial was going to, or pardon me, sentencing was going to be the next day, and the sentencing was continued for several months. And I believe Judge Cahill told Ms. Cao, you can go to Dr. Ackland, talk to him and see what exactly you want him to do, whether it's a written report or something else. Did she ever come back and say he could do a written report and testify for 1,800, or he says he just can't do it, anything like that in the record?
There's nothing in the record that I can see. So, you know, there's certainly nothing to suggest that the $1,000 was insufficient. Although, you know, to be fair, the record doesn't indicate one way or another.
Yeah, but there's no motion, like, you know, supplemental motion or declaration of Megan Cao in support of motion. I talked on this date to Dr. Ackland?
Correct.
Yeah. And he advised that for $1,000, all he could do would be X, and that's not sufficient. Nothing like that, at least not in the record.
Nothing in the record. That's correct.
Where did that 8,700 come from? Was that a quote from Dr. Ackland?
Yes, that was invoiced in and attached to the ex parte motion for costs. And it includes quite a bit of hours in prepping. I think it was 10 hours for courtroom prep, 8 hours for an evaluation with the defendant, all of these at $300 an hour. So I think that Judge Cahill's statement as to the expenses are well-founded given the amount and the rate of the
price. Right, but you're saying there's no evidence of insufficiency, but that was his asking price, and they only gave him $1,000. It was insufficient on its face.
Insufficient for Dr. Ackland, right. But the petitioner is not entitled to the psychiatrist of his choice. So perhaps he could have got a different expert. We don't know. There's nothing in the record to indicate one way or another, like I said.
Thank you.
Could you move on to the issue regarding the nature of the sentencing or how sentencing was handled? And I asked Mr. Combe the question of whether this court can or should consider whether the sentence was vindictive in the sense of being consecutive rather than concurrent. Could you address that issue and give us your perspective?
Yes, Your Honor. So my reading of the briefs in this case indicates that petitioner did not raise this issue until the last two pages of its application for cert. There's some discussion about sentencing disparities before the ICA, but those are disparities between criminal defendants. On its application for cert, petitioner raises an issue of disparity between the first sentence and the second sentence. And those are different arguments. So I would definitely argue that the petitioner waived that argument. However, if the court is to go to the merits, I don't believe that this court has ever, asked what constitutes a harsher sentence under North Carolina v. Pierce. And there are a couple of different approaches around the country, the most common being the aggregate approach, which looks at the total sentence pre-appeal and the total sentence post-appeal. The second approach is the remainder aggregate approach, which looks at the aggregate sentence at trial and the remainder of the counts following the appeal. So if some counts were reduced or dismissed or reversed, then those counts aren't considered under the remainder aggregate approach. A very small minority of jurisdictions follow the count-by-count approach, and that looks at each individual count to determine whether or not the sentence was harsher. And if one of those counts is harsher, then there is that presumption of vindictiveness. I asked the court to adopt the aggregate approach if it gets to the merits of this issue. the reason why that is the majority approach in other jurisdictions is because it takes into account the sentencing judge's entire sentencing scheme and allows it to fashion a sentence that it chooses. And if that sentence unravels by virtue of the appeal, the court can still come back and look at a holistic sentencing scheme. I think that the other approaches don't take into account that totality of the circumstances that is crucial, I believe, for the sentencing court. And there's been some suggestion that at least the count-by-count approach can have a chilling effect on sentencing judges, whereby they create harsher sentences in order to insulate themselves from the presumption of vindictiveness should the case come back from appeal. So if the court were to go to the merits of that issue, I think that the aggregate approach is the best approach, and that's evidenced by the amount of jurisdictions that have adopted that approach.
Is that what the federal courts do now, or would this be as a matter of state constitutional law? Because the Shack case actually was applying the federal constitution. So
it does. And Shack did apply the federal constitution. There is a somewhat of a circuit split in that regard. I think the 2nd and the 11th circuits have either the remainder aggregate approach or the count-by-count approach. Sometimes those are sort of muddled together because they are somewhat similar. But all the other circuits, to my knowledge, use the aggregate approach. And a number of states do as well.
Which states use the count-by-count approach?
At least Colorado. I believe California as well. In every case that I read regarding the aggregate approach, it is labeled as the majority approach. But I can't tell you all of the cases, all of the states that follow that approach. As to the petitioner's argument that the state needed to somehow address, the state or the court needed to somehow address the mitigating factors, I think it's evident from the nature of the plea agreement that the state had already acknowledged that the defendant was suffering from an extreme mental or emotional distress. And that's the reason why the charge was lowered to manslaughter. And I don't think that the court needs to specifically dispel every single mitigating factor. The case law says that the court doesn't need to address every single 706-606 factor. So I think it also follows that the court doesn't need to specifically dispel every mitigating factor that a defendant might raise. There are an unlimited amount of mitigating factors that may be presented and in an unlimited amount of ways. So I think it's not practical, and it's too onerous on the sentencing court to require it to go factor by factor that the defendant is raising and mitigate each one, when by analyzing the 706-606 factors as the trial court did here, there is a meaningful rationale for the defendant, the victim's family, and the public to assess whether the consecutive sentence was appropriate. And I think that's exactly what the court did here. This case is more Kong and Hussein as opposed to Barrios, Batista, and Sandoval. There is one consecutive sentence. All of the factors and the discussion that the circuit court had regarding those factors all speak directly to the consecutive sentence, the single consecutive sentence in this case. So I think the record was more than sufficient to support a consecutive sentence. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I ask you to affirm the judgment of the circuit court. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. Mr. Combe, your response.
Thank you. Briefly, I appreciate the court's time. Justice Edens, you said, is there anything in the record?
Could you please lift the microphone?
Oh, yeah, good.
Pardon me. You asked if there's anything in the record that indicate that he couldn't hire his own expert. I would point out that he was court appointed. Both Ms. Cao agreed to do this as a favor.
Well, I meant hire an expert for $1,000.
Oh, pardon me. Well, I would point out on that argument is kind of perhaps a little bit misplaced. On one hand, supposedly there's statistics that say people do it for $1,000. That's probably a report where they're reviewing medical and maybe they meet with a person for 40 minutes. Whereas the government has also said that Dr. Atkins was paid $7,500 at trial the first time around. I didn't realize that. So, you know, that's an indication of what somebody's going to get paid to have to spend more time and to show up and to testify. So I would ask this court to view that the $1,000 is a way of not denying it and just pushing it off. It is a violation of due process, or this court could get there because it's not realistic. That
would it be a violation of due process if the court disallowed him to testify in court?
Absolutely. And I'm sorry, you mean the
at the sentencing,
the expert, the doctor, or the defendant?
The doctor.
Of course.
I mean, the defendant has a right to allocution.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think so, if they want to present it. And the problem I have is the comments, pardon me, the problem that may be apparent, or I would urge this court to look at is the comments that were made at sentencing, which indicated, you know, it wasn't likely that the court would even be receptive to hearing such arguments. And I would point out, I'm sorry that I'm segueing a little bit, in 706-606, it also suggested under like Barrios and Bautista that there should have been an explanation or some way of addressing the issue of the EMED plea and why the court was discounting it or still nonetheless going to do consecutive sentencing, because the court had to address the defendant's history and his characteristics under 706-606. They also need to look at the nature and circumstance of the offense, which involved these things, which appears that they agreed to a plea saying there was a spontaneous EMED thing that occurred, but yet the sentencing was, and the arguments made were more premeditated action. And that could suggest that the defendant didn't get a full, fair look at his sentencing on the issue of consecutive sentencing. Could the court have done it? Absolutely. I'm asking this court to say that it wasn't done correctly, and some comments in the record are troubling.
Mr. Combe, did you find where in your reply brief you argued?
I do not, and okay. And I may have had it in my opening brief, but I know that in all candor to the court is there was a few sentences at the end of a topic where I said something to the effect of that, and I talk about how the gun charge was made consecutive instead of being concurrent like it was the first time around. I if the court directs me, I can supplement and file something.
We've looked through the record and we'll look again, make sure. Thank you. No need at this point. Anything further for the court, Mr. Combe, to wrap up?
If the court has any questions, I can answer them, but I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you to both our counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki ike anohana. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.